Lesson for today is from 1 Corinthians 4, 1 through 5. Think of us in this way, as servants of Christ and stewards of God's mysteries. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found trustworthy. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or any human court. I do not even judge myself. I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive commendation from God. So the title of the sermon shares a theme that hip suburban Gen Xers can appreciate. Before Tupac Shakur said it, Paul said it in our passage for today, only God can judge me. We'll talk about this concept of judgment at some length, but it's important to situate for the kind of sake of our understanding of Corinthians why Paul, bless you, wants to talk about the concept of judgment right now. So, you know, just to recap, we've been talking about this bless you letter to the Corinthians, and so far we've talked about what a real apocalypse is. The kind of point I made was that a real apocalypse is the revelation of knowledge that fundamentally disorients the way you understand the world and relate to the world. Then we talked about how that knowledge, like Paul talks about the cross, in many ways is beyond our ability to grasp it or internalize it. And then we talked about how Paul wanted to take a Christian community and get it to kind of build itself on this principle of the death and resurrection of Christ as being something that is beyond our grasp, and yet something that is our foundation. So one of the things Paul's trying to say is that if we really get the logic of the cross, if we get what God is trying to do in incarnation and dying and in resurrecting, what happens to us is a radical transformation. We become oriented towards the person of Christ. We learn to die to ourselves, and we learn to put aside every kind of connection that we have, whether it's an idea, a habit, a tradition, a practice, whatever it is that orients us towards the world and towards other people that is not either filtered through or laid on the foundation of Christ, we are to put to death. And Paul is taking this idea that the cross and the idea of the cross and Christ crucified and Christ is the foundation is the thing that ought to orient how we live together and how we live as a church. And it's one of those things that being in Christ and being influenced by Christ and dying to ourselves means that we might have to, and I mean this specifically for those of us who are good churchgoers, that we might have to give up some of our ways of thinking about and judging and engaging our world, right? Because the reason why Paul says the cross is a stumbling block is because it ought to do something that disrupts, that interrupts, that changes the way we think about our world. If the cross doesn't serve as a challenge to us, we're not doing it right. And in all this, we've seen, and I think this is a great theme for the city of Corinth, that Paul's kind of driving this critique of the pagan spirit of Corinth. We talked a lot about Corinth as being this city that had more temples to more gods than you could imagine. Paganism, properly defined, if you remember from last week, is not simply about worshiping the wrong god. It's not about, Trey does this all the time, dancing around in goat leggings, for example. Paganism is an attitude or a way of thinking and living that says that I believe what I believe because of where I came from, because of the place where I was born, because of the family or the ideas that I received. Paganism is a set of inherited beliefs. And ultimately, if you're a good pagan, you don't really care if those beliefs are consistent with themselves or consistent with the beliefs of others. Remember the Latin roots of paganism that we talked about last week, pagus. Pagus meant to be an inhabitant of a village. Before it meant to be a person who worshipped a heathen god in later Latin, it meant that you were a person who thought and believed and did what you did because of the specific location that you were from. So to be a pagan originally was to say, you believe what you believe because it mirrors the beliefs of those around you, because it mirrors the community that you're tied to. And more than that, a good pagan believes that they believe what they believe, and other people are going to believe what they're going to believe. And there's no reason for anyone to say, this belief is better than that belief. There's no reason to resolve it. Because good paganism, in the end, it's virtue. And in my opinion, its shortcoming is that it says everyone has the right to believe what it is that's worthwhile to them based on their tradition, their cultural location, etc. Now, there's a modern version of this belief. And I mean, I hate to say it, but modern folks are largely pagan in that sense. We are. We say, I know what I know, I believe what I believe, my opinions are mine, and not only do I have a right to my opinion, but I have a right for my opinion to be right. In fact, no one really should be able to question it. See, but Paul is saying that if Christ is the foundation of everything, if we want to build a new temple that surpasses the other ones, we can't continue to think this way. Our new temple, which is Christ's body, is not just something that we believe because we believe it, but Christ's death and resurrection makes a claim on the beliefs of all people. That's the funny thing about a foundation, whether or not you are thinking about the existence of this building's foundation, even whether or not you believe in the existence of this building's foundation, it is holding up the floor. It is making it possible for us to be in this room. There's a issue with the kind of paganism that says everyone believe what they want to believe, no one ever has to sort anything out, because what it does is it makes it difficult for us to say that we're committed to the idea of truth. Now, usually at this point in a sermon, we'd queue up reflections on how Christians should fight the culture wars. I don't think that's the shtick Paul's addressing. I want to take it a little bit different direction. I don't think that Paul's super worried here about taking a stand in the name of, you know, what our religion or practice tells us is holy. I don't think Paul's asking for a blistering critique of relativism. The real issue is that when we think our understanding of the world, our understanding of the cosmos, our relationship to other people, and our relationship to God is about reaffirming what's important to us, about what we hold dear, when we think that our spiritual practice is essentially about baptizing the things that are our desires, we miss something big. We miss the opportunity to know and love Christ and to know and love others. That's the problem with paganism. If you say what I believe is what I believe and it's good because I believe it and I'm unwilling to enter it into or make determinations about its truth, you ignore the fact that there really is a Savior who really has come to save you. There really is a logic that constitutes the universe. There really is a foundation that is the basis for the church. The problem with being a pagan is not that you were wrong per se. This is the interesting thing to me. I think you could be, in this sense, and I think we all know, in this sense, people who are Christian pagans. They're Christian pagans in the sense that I say, well, I go to church, I say the creed, I believe what I believe because I believe it, but other people have truths for them, other people have ways of thinking about their world. Christianity is right for me, their belief is right for them, who am I to say yes or no for that? But in that model, even though a person could believe everything that we might agree with doctrinally, Christ is not really the underlying foundation of reality. The cross is really not the singular event in history. The resurrection is not the hope of the cosmos, not really, because the Christian pagan believes that while these things are true for him or her, they are not really true in the sense that they are independent of any person's particular perception of them, right? Isn't that kind of the way we learn to believe things in the modern world, as we say something is right for us because of our position, our social location, and we in fact reaffirm that it's okay to, that most religious practice is ultimately culturally located. And that is the crucial thing about paganism. See, Christian paganism, or paganism more generally, it buys into, and the church at Corinth would begin to buy into, this dangerous view that what's true or right or good is a result of us assenting to it. Is as opposed to the idea that what's true is totally independent from our perception of it. See, paganism sees the human mind as the measure of all things, as opposed to seeing it as on a search to know something external to us, which is right or true or good or beautiful or judgeable on other means. Well, if that's the case, pagans have this weird problem when it comes to the truth. Because the point of the truth in this model is saying it's all about you. And if you think the truth is all about you, there's nothing that stops you from believing in something that is totally disconnected from external reality. Reality, in fact, would not just be a figment of your imagination. It would be an extension or a product of your imagination. Pagans would tend to have this crushing problem with confirmation bias. If you go through the world thinking and reading all evidence to shore up or to support what it is you already believe, you shouldn't be very surprised that you repeatedly come to the same kinds of conclusions. But Paul says the cross should serve as a stumbling block, as an apocalypse, as something that trips you literally when you're walking in your reality, as something that says your way of putting together the world is informed by the flesh and the limitedness of the human psyche. Paul says if we are not tripped by the cross, if our ways of thinking are not interrupted by the cross, if we aren't upset in some way, if we aren't in some way reoriented and disoriented by the cross, then we aren't doing Christianity right. Because Christ's death is not an ultimate reality to us, and his resurrection is not the ultimate hope for us. See, that's what Paul's talking about today when he talks about the idea of judgment. The passage for today begins with, if you want to be way more interesting or way less interesting at cocktail parties, it begins with a rhetorical device called an amphiboly. Okay, so an amphiboly is a rhetorical device where you have a concept or a referent with an unclear object. So that concept or referent could apply to two things. So Paul begins this and says, think of us in this way. And the question is, who is the us? The first us could be, in the immediately preceding passage we talked about last week, Paul's talking about Apollos and Cephas, right? And he's saying, well, here's, think of us means, think about guys like me and Apollos and Cephas as dot, 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 dot. But in the Greek, it's equally permissible to say, think of us in this way. Think of those of us who are in the church who are servants of Christ. So anyway, Paul starts out, and I think what he's saying is that he's intentionally kind of referring to both. It's the kind of thing that an editor or an English teacher would underline and say, unclear referent. But the unclear referent has a point here. Paul is saying that both for the leadership of the Christian community and for the individual Christian, for each person who is called to be for Christ, for each person who is called to resign themselves to the knowledge of Christ, to the truth of Christ, each of those persons is called to act in a certain way. And Paul says, each of us is called to be servants. Now, here's what's amazing about this part of this passage. Look at it closely. He says, Paul says that we are asked to be servants of Christ and stewards of God's mysteries. Now, the words for servant and steward, bless you, typically just translate for servant. The two words define this kind of funny split about the Christian life. So he says, on one hand, we are servants of Christ. And the Greek word here is huperitas, which basically means to be a slave, but it was a name for a very specific kind of slave. Okay, so the huperitas is a guy that you might have seen in the movies. You've definitely seen him in Game of Thrones. The huperitas is the guy that sat in the very, very bottom of a galley. And like, he'd sit, you know, three or four to a row, packed in together tight. There was a narrow aisle where a guy could walk through with a whip or whatever, and then there was another row, and the huperitas was the guy that all he did was row. And he could see the head of the guy in front of him, maybe. He couldn't really see out the ship. He was a guy who was basically designed and optimized for the best huperitas, was simply one that translated virtually effortlessly the word to row or to slow down or to speed up directly into mechanical motion. The huperitas never saw the ocean outside of them. They didn't get to make tactical decisions. They just knew that their job was to row exactly how they were told to row. And it's a decent description of the Christian life from one perspective. Don't think, row. Row when you're told. The second word, the word for steward there, is oikonomos. The person who manages the laws of the house. It's actually the word that we directly get our word for economy from. The oikonomos did not make calls. There was the slave or a servant who basically ran a household. They didn't make calls about what the household should do. They didn't make calls about what was the right strategy for the house to prosper. The master did that. But the oikonomos was a steward who made choices about implementing the master's will. So the master would say, we want the house to do this. Oikonomos, your job is to go implement it. And so in that sense, Christians should understand themselves to be two distinct kinds of servants. Or the kinds of servants who, like the guys in the bottom of the ship, when we're told to row or exert effort, we should just do it without thinking about it. But we're also called, in this weird way, to be stewards of, to be implementers of, to be managers of God's house, and to take direction from God and use that direction in order to direct where the church ought to go to do what we can to build the kingdom. Now, you can imagine that if you were a ship rower, at one point you might think, wow, this is not really the strategy for winning the battle. And if you were in a household with multiple stewards, you could see the household kind of breaking down around individual stewards saying, oh, well, you know, that's not really the best way to maximize what the master intended. And so two stewards might fight and say, here's what I think the master demands. And the other steward might say, you're out of it. I know the master better than you. But notice that in each of these scenarios, there is a little bit of good Corinthian paganism sneaking in to how the servants function. It's the paganism that says that my understanding of where the ship ought to go, or my understanding of what best maximizes the goals or profitability of the house, is better than the judgment of the captain or the master. That kind of paganism would make for terrible naval strategy, and it'd make for terrible household management. In fact, it's the opposite of a good steward. Paul says in verse 2, moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found trustworthy. Trustworthy in what? Trustworthy in carrying out and acting as a proxy for the master without relying on their own sense of the validity or the superiority of their own judgment. So here's the kind of nugget of the passage. Paul is talking about each one of us as being servants of God, as being servants of the risen Christ. And as being servants of the risen Christ, our job is to lay aside our own understandings of what is right or what is good or what is proper, and to defer utterly and completely to Jesus to be directed where we need to go. And if you follow that idea, what it implies is that we should even limit the thing that we think helps us be most holy. We limit our judgments. Paul goes Tupac here. Only God can judge me. He says, but it was with me a small thing that I should be judged by you or any human court. I do not even judge myself. I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Think about what Paul's saying here. It seems straightforward, but the implications are huge. We love to say, if you're a kid in the modern humanities and in our culture at large, that humans are creatures of community, that we're born in and shaped by the society that we live in, that we're shaped and formed by relationships, and that's how God intended it. But each person in this room has experienced the negative side of this necessity of life and community, haven't we? Is there any person that you know that, despite their claims to not really care, that doesn't in some way crave the recognition of others? Is there any person that, whether you like it or not, is often not worried in some excessive manner about what other people think about us, about our performance, about our choices, about our person? And if it's not people at large, there may be a specific person. You see, there's this kind of subtle tyranny to human community. And the worst part is, we do it to ourselves. For those of you, you know, think back to high school, or kids, think about your school. Adults probably are in some community that replicates this dynamic. Nothing reveals the psychosis of our culture of judgment and recognition like the great phenomena of being cool in high school, especially when it comes to fashion. This is my experience. On one hand, in our culture, we're told that our whole point is to be radically individual, to express our individuality in every way possible, and we take a secret pleasure in being a person who is different from every other person in some way. We take a secret pleasure in the way we act, the way we behave, the way we dress, the way we talk, the things that we're interested in, the people we surround ourselves by. We're always constantly marking out and defining our individuality. But there's this other tendency at work just below the surface of our self-proclaimed individuality. And the best experience I had of it was in high school, which is that for every kid in my high school that was so busy trying to stake out their individuality, it was weird how they basically broke down into like three or four groups where they acted exactly the same way as every other member of the group. In the effort to become radically individual, people became radically similar. They'd do it in ways that would fit into a clique or a group. They'd do it in ways that identified them as a member of a community. What we experience in most communities, in my opinion, is this weird tension between demonstrating our individuality and also being tied to the recognition and judgments of others. And in doing so, we become totally unfree in the way we commit ourselves to individuality. We become totally bound to the desires and recognition of other people. And if you're honest with yourself, you then become totally bound to making judgments about other people, because to judge other people is not simply to say that someone else is wrong, but it is to put you in line with a group of fellow people who share judgments. Paul sees this as the primary dynamic that is killing the church in Corinth, that there is a subtle paganism slipping in that says that we're not all on one foundation of Christ, but instead we're on the foundation of our individual groups, of our individual cliques, and that foundation is eclipsing our ability to see the person of Christ, to see Christ as the foundation of the community, and instead for us to be caught up in and bound up in judging and being approved by our peers. It doesn't get any better when you're adults. Sorry, kids. We live our lives partially for the approval of our peers. We worry about the expectations of others. We worry about how they'll judge the choices that we will make and the things that we'll do. We worry about propriety. We worry about decorum. We participate in this tyranny of community by judging and defining those who break the norms we hold. But the thing is, here's the craziest part about it. It's a fundamental part of our sin nature that no one forces us to judge this way. But we do it automatically because it aligns us with the communities that we're in. Have you ever listened to yourself deliver something that was totally BS? Have you ever had someone ask you about something that would have put you in a negative light and heard yourself giving an explanation of it, and the words were coming out of your mouth like a gilded, crappy lily, and despite your confidence and despite the way that you presented yourself in front of those other people for the sake of saving your reputation and for the sake of saving your face, deep inside your mind, there's a little bit of you that says, well, this is total BS. I mean, if we're all honest, we've had this experience, don't we? Maybe not. Maybe Beth hasn't, but others of us have, where we find ourselves determined by and determined to seem like we're better in the recognitions and the judgments of other people. It is paganism. It is the root of paganism. It is the tendency to define ourselves in relationship to others through our habits and practices to signal the group that we belong to. It is ultimately about making my judgment and my acceptability more important than doing what orients me towards Christ. And guess what? Not only does it make it petty and judgmental, but it causes us to engage the world in ways that divide it. The word that Paul uses here for judgment is absolutely brilliant. There's lots of Greek words for judgment. It's like a big deal for them. But the one word he uses here is anakrino. Okay, krino is the same word that we get our concept for crisis from. The Greeks had this brilliant thing in the word krino because it both meant things were like messed up and crisis like we might think about it, but it also means you had to make a choice. And ana means cross. So anakrino, judgment, is to say it's like sifting. It's like guilty or innocent. It's like yes or no. Anakrino is a two-sided kind of judgment that divides one thing from the other. What Paul's talking about is our tendency in communities to anakrino, to say you're in, you're out, you're good, you're bad. It's like the kind of judgment that a convict receives at a trial. He or she is with the innocent citizen, or he or she is with the group of criminals. Anakrino is judgment by separation. But Christian judgment is not anakrino. It's not making separations and saying, this is the good side of the community and this is the bad side of community. The Christian vision of judgment says that we are building a new temple. It's not based on who's in or who's out. We're all in. We are all built on the foundation of Christ. The foundation and the principle of Christian judgment is not division, but it's what benefits the whole. The Christian understanding of judgment that is not anakrino is that we're not sifting into the context of the Christian community, but instead we say, what is the best for the whole? whole? How is it that we can bring in our brothers and sisters? How is it that we can make it so that we are not divided? The Christian, in the context of the Christian community, surrenders the need to say, you're good, you're bad, you're better, you're pious, you're not pious. We surrender that need, and instead we say, we're all fallen, we're all loved, we are all built on the foundation of Christ, and therefore we are freed from guilt, and we are freed from judgment, and we are able to be the kind of people that God calls us to be. We are able not to live in fear or not to live in condemnation, but to live in love. Paul is saying that if Christ is our foundation, then we are one in him, and we are freed from the tyranny of human judgment. We are freed from the tyranny of worrying about what other people think. We are freed from the constant monologue that goes on in the back of our minds that tells us that we're not good enough, that tells us that people don't care about us or don't know about us or don't understand our actions, because we are building a temple that is firmly set on Christ the foundation. And that means we reconsider the very human tendency to judge ourselves and to judge others and to say, he's bad or she's good or he's in or she's out. And instead we replace it with a commitment to love and mutual submission to Christ. Think about how far Paul takes this. Paul takes this commitment so far, he said a little bit earlier, that not only does he not listen to human judgments about him, his ministry, but what? He won't even judge himself. Can you imagine the freedom and the grace that is open to you when you think this way? Not judging himself doesn't mean that he's not guilty of something. Not judging himself means he doesn't worry about it, because he knows that in the end, it is only God that judges him. In the case of Christian community, he lays aside his judgment of himself and others, and instead he just puts himself towards working towards the glory of the church. We love the power that our human moralism gives us. We love occupying the position of the judge. It's really hard to give up. Believe me, I love it. It's one of my favorite things to do. But despite the fact that we love it, it is what makes us and our community miserable. I know so many people who live lives like myself, even, that are marked by guilt and regret about things. If I would have done this or not done that, if I would have done this differently, if only I would have made better decisions, I feel so bad for the decisions that person has made, yada, yada, yada. Those judgments, as my boy Luther pointed out, are based on a fundamentally flawed and somewhat pagan assumption. And that's this. They're based on the belief that I or you could have done or been otherwise. That's why Luther says, peccatia fortiae, sin boldly. Not because sin is good, but because Christ is our judge. And at the cross, we have been judged, found guilty, and everything in us that is bad has been put to death. We have been freed from the consequences of it, and we are able to be open to and to live into him, flaws and all, to live in love, in him, with him, and through him. I'm not arguing for some like blasé hippie of acceptance of whatever comes our way. I'm trying to say something more radical. To give yourself fully and totally over to God's infinite and agapic love, to admit that he loves you and values you as you are, independent of what you do, to know that you are precious and fearfully and wonderfully made, so that instead of thinking about the Christian life as a kind of exercise and in having ever more technical judgments of yourself, that you should love and be loved, and that in doing so, you leave judgment to God, because only God can judge us. And in doing so, you give up the need to divide the Christian community by saying yes, no, him, her, right, wrong, guilty, innocent. And instead, you embrace the idea that we are one people based on one foundation, building one temple. And instead, we don't look at the other person with a judgment that divides, but we look at the other person with a heart of love that gives to them, that seeks their good, that even holds people accountable when they do things which aren't in line with building a better church. But the point is that it's not a judgment that starts from division. It starts from commonality and similarity, and it seeks the good of everyone. We're not called to give up on judging the justice or rightness of things or institutions or actions or behaviors. In fact, we are called to burn with a holy love against everything that separates us from people, from God, and from one another. But we are called not to judge on the basis of what is inclusive or exclusive. Instead, we're called to judge on the basis of a rule that Christ has given us. And that rule is that we don't wallow in judgments of the person nor of ourselves, because in the ultimate court, we have already been found guilty and we have already been set free from those consequences that could be imposed on us. And so we are released simply to love. Therefore, Paul says, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and disclose the purposes of the heart. Each one will receive commendation from God. And that's the thing. To that church, building that temple, and to our church, building our temple, to build Christian lives and communities together, Paul is saying that we need to surrender our tendency to judge in these kind of diametric terms, to self-justify, to berate ourselves, to measure ourselves against any human standard, and instead we are called to live together in this beautiful, incomprehensible, ecstatic, corporate joy that revels in the call that God has placed on all of us. We are called to be Christian without regret. We are called to free ourselves from the insidious paganism that constantly holds us to be the judge of our own actions, because that is the voice of the old man. And instead, we are called to live in to what Christ has called us to do, to love with relentless abandon. Praise God, you are free, you are loved, the penalty has been paid. Don't worry about what other rowers or stewards of the house think of you. Don't hold yourself to paralyzing standards of perfection. Don't hold yourself to a vision that says you are anything less than an appointed and anointed child of God, but instead live a life that wraps yourself in love, that luxuriates in the call that he has been given us. For the person who is transformed by him, guilt is dead, the old master is impotent, and all that is left for us is to seek his voice together and to love in response to hearing it. So row and steward the mystery of all that he has revealed to us, because we build one temple on one foundation, and that foundation is Christ's love. Amen. Small group discussion. What do you got?
So, two things, Chris. The first would be, how do you resolve what you're talking about? You know, where we commune together without kind of separation or judgment or whatever with Christ. I forget which gospel it is, but with that part of the gospel where he says, you know, I come not to bring peace but a sword, you know, pitting brother against brother, you know, mother against sister. I forget all the things, but that seems, now I'm kind of thinking of it while you were talking, that kind of seems like it's not getting away from what you're saying, which is only Christ can judge, so only maybe Christ can bring that kind of sword and that kind of division in the community. But I was just wondering if you have...
Yeah, I take that to be consistent with the thread that critiques paganism.
Okay.
So if we are really ultimately in a community where our primary identification is Christ, then there are all kinds of old patterns and habits that we have that cease to be primary or defining patterns for us. So
the reason why some people, I think, get wrong the biblical version of family values is that I don't think that the Bible baptizes the idea of the nuclear family as being the primary site for everything that's meaningful. I think the Bible says that Christ and the Christian community become a new family, the new point for everything that's meaningful. And so when Christ says, I come to put a sword in part, what Christ is saying is that you are now defined primarily by your affinity to Christ and to the church than you are by your affinity to where you were born or who raised you. That doesn't mean you should like be jerks to your parents or whatever, but it just means that the primary thing that ties us to other people in the context of the building the new temple is that we love and serve God, and so we suspend judgment in a certain way about whether or not someone is in or out. We accept everyone as being in if they confess Christ, and then we think about how to best love each other and advance the needs of the kingdom.
And the second thing, so my wife is actually going to lead her pagan circle today.
I'm not sure. No, I know.
So, but like, does when you... And this seems relatively easy, but you basically seem to be advocating that, and Paul seems to be advocating that, the objective reality of the foundation of your of salvation through Christ is an external object, and we deal with this problem obviously all the time. But like, you know, is an external object by which your belief in it or adherence to it is not it. Does not help that thing exist or not exist. It's there prior to community's experience and perception of it as a reality.
I guess the thing I'm saying, and I thought about, you know, I mean, I have a bunch, I mean, anyone in the academy, right? You've got pagan-leaning friends. And part of this is to redefine how we think about what's pagan. Right? Because
So are those people saved based on Christ's resurrection and sacrifice being just a material object that is independent of everyone's perception?
Above my pay grade. I like to hope that my answer on that is always Hans Urs von Balthasar, that we should pray and act as if not everyone is saved, but we should hope and believe that that's a real possibility, yada yada yada. But what the thing I define paganism as is not you worship a pagan god. The thing I define paganism as, and I think the original meaning of pagan before it meant heathen, the original meaning of pagan was that you were a person who believed what you believed because of the village that you came from. So like when I asked Annabeth last week, if she's paying attention, Annabeth, how do you pick a Greek god?
You pick them by, like, who you are. Like, if you were a sailor, then you would worship Poseidon.
That's paganism. Paganism is saying, I believe in Poseidon because I'm a sailor. I believe in, you know, Aphrodite because I'm a temple worker. I believe in X, Y, or Z because I do X. And so in each instance, it's the personal identity. Because that's the big thread that I think underlies a lot of this is identity. It's like, do we think that our identity determines our choices about God, or do we think that God determines the possibilities for our identity? And I think the pagan ethos says the God I pick is something that fits with my identity, as opposed to saying the point of being subject to the cross and to Christ is to say that one of the things that's neat but tough about Christianity is it really doesn't give a crap about whatever it is that your initial identity was. It asks for a radical reconfiguration of it towards something different.
Is there something significant in the sense that at the end of verse 5, Paul mentions each one will receive his commendation, but he doesn't say condemnation either.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And in 3:15, he talks about, I think if anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved.
Yeah.
So the whole concept that Paul's kind of talking about is the judgment that counts is God's.
Yep.
And to the degree that we are his, it's all good.
That's right.
If we work as good stewards,
yep,
and then in essence what he's given us to work with can only lead to commendation.
That's right.
If we do a good job.
And in the end of the 5, and your tie back to, you know, 8 being saved but only as through the fire is a really interesting part of that. I think you're absolutely right to say cumulatively what that means is that the vision of Christian work is that we give ourselves over to serve God, and we are valued because of the person that we are, made in the image of God, as opposed to valued by the product that we produce. And we can lose that product. You know, Resurrection Church could collapse tomorrow, and each one of us, though we'd be sad about the character of the church, had put in and attended and had the motive of doing what we could to build the kingdom in our community. And what we are commended for is that commitment, independent of the kind of product that it produces. So Christianity inaugurates this radical separation between person and product that says the person is valued and loved infinitely. The product is good, but the product isn't the thing that determines the value of the person. So let's just give up judgment and let God take care of it in the end by commending us for motives that we had towards the good and suspending us from the consequences that we might have otherwise incurred because of the bad.
So Jonah wasn't a good prophet because Nineveh was saved. He was a good prophet because ultimately he went.
Yep. Yep. Well, I mean, do you think it's consistent with the Jonah story to think that, or is that, would we have to go radical supersessionist?
No, we never go supersessionist. No, I think that's true. I mean, I think that's one thing that seems to be a consistent, you know, especially in the Old Testament, it seems to be this, like, really consistent testimony that the world doesn't make a lot of sense a lot of times, that, like, bad people are rewarded and good people are not. And that's not ultimately what determines who's right and who's wrong. I mean, Job.
Yep.
So that's a DeGrasse Tyson line, isn't it? The world's under no obligation to make sense to you.
Yeah, right.
The universe.
Yeah.
Well, and how does this fit? I kind of remember, I'm not an expert on Pauline letters, Chris, but like...
Me neither.
I kind of remember Paul is pretty judgy, like, in certain letters. So how does this kind of fit in with the rest of that?
Yeah, I think what he's saying is that it's almost like a version of the office of a prophet. Right? So the prophet doesn't make the judgment on the basis of them being great. The prophet just says, God gives me a word, and I say that word, and I say that word independent of whatever it is that I've done. And Paul is like, also, as judgy as Paul gets, Paul's constantly like, I'm not saying I'm not doing anything wrong. I've got a thorn in the flesh. I'm as fallen as anybody else. And so I think what it means is that Paul is trying to radically separate the condition of judgment from the person, because persons are infinitely loved and valued, but God still wants things to get done. And the point of Paul's injunctions to the community in most instances is something that's about the good of the whole or the good of the community, as opposed to the judgment of an individual person. It's very rare that he calls out a specific person. It isn't rare that he says he calls out faction or he calls out things that work contrary to the good of the whole. All right, prayers of the people. Most of your texts are blowing up here, you know. Someone's probably got a eye that's on fire or something.
Sorry.
Hey, but.